Well, if you're comfortable, we can go ahead and talk.
Sure.
All right. So, Elizabeth, how did you become interested in the subject of repetition in music?
Well, it probably goes back to my time as an undergraduate studying piano at the Peabody Conservatory of Music. Really, all I wanted to do at that time of my life was practice piano. And it happened that my major professor, my piano teacher, she told me that it was really important that I not do very much else aside from practice the piano.
And I mean, this must be your life.
And but our conservatory was affiliated with a university down the road, Johns Hopkins, and there was a bus that if you had initiative, you could hop on and go take some other courses. But, you know, my teacher told me that was forbidden, it was impossible. So, of course, I got on the bus and I went. And I took a class called Minds, Brains, and Computers with Paul Smolensky, really mostly on a whim, just because I thought it sounded interesting. And already in the second day of that class, music came up as an interesting case about how the mind works. And I was hooked. And from that day forward, I finished out my degree in piano, but I was constantly distracted by all kinds of questions about what we were doing and how we were doing it and why. And central to those was just this way that we tended to interact with music, going back again and again to the music we loved. And I found it fascinating.
Yeah, there's a wonderful point you make that, you know, if you told the same story to someone twice, let alone 15 times, that person would kind of start avoiding you in the hallways. But we'll listen to the same piece of music again and again and again. Why is that?
Well, I think that this really points to something, an interesting way that music is not really like a language. So, I mean, it's one of those metaphors that's really out there. When I was growing up, I went to Interlochen Arts Camp, and over the big stage there, they have it emblazoned in large letters. Music is the universal language. But maybe there are some things going on in music that aren't really the same as what's going on in language. And I'll give you some examples, maybe. So when we think back to what happened in a story somebody told us, we tend to remember the gist of what happened, not the specific words they used to tell the story to us. Mm-hmm. But if we try to remember back to a song we listened to or a piece we really enjoyed, there's something about the actual specific sequence of notes that is still very present and verbatim in our memory, and in fact really gripping. So if you try to remember, maybe I'll give you an example.
So you don't necessarily remember the overall plot or shape of a Beethoven concerto, but you could probably hum some of your favorite bars.
That's exactly right. So there's a great example that Mark DeBellis uses in a book he wrote called Conceptualizing Music, where he asks, if you think about the Star Spangled Banner, right, and you think, okay, the word O and the word U, were those sung on the same pitch? And really, to answer that question, what you have to do is go back in and sing through the tune.
Yeah, I just did it in my head while you were talking.
Yeah, you can't just duck in and get to one little snippet. They're all welded together so tightly in your mind that one note seems to just kind of inevitably spill out of the preceding one. And I think that tight connection from note to note is really an effect that is created through repetition.
Hmm. Well, you have a fact that fascinates me in this day where everybody's, you know, filling up their iPod with new music constantly. You say that 90% of the music people hear is music they've heard before. Really?
Really? That's our best estimate. And it really flies in the face of what people like to think about themselves. So if you ask them what they listen to, they'll, as I do to my students every semester, they'll all say, I like to listen to all kinds of music. Everything's great for me. And then you ask them just to duck into their iTunes program and take a look at their track play statistics, and they've listened to the latest Coldplay album 825 times, you know? They lie. And the question is, why do we lie about that to ourselves? Why can we not really admit that that's what we do? And I think it's that repetition has really had a bad rap. People have thought that it's regressive, maybe kind of uncomfortably affiliated with insanity. And it's taken some time for repetition to be able to come out of the cellar in which it was locked and for us to take a look at it and not be so ashamed of it, but try to understand what its role really might be.
So it may be just, maybe I think to myself, well, I'm secretly not that adventurous about music. I know that I kind of listen to the same five bands over and over and over again. But in fact, everybody else is doing that too.
Rest assured, you're not alone.
So is there any research that indicates what's going on in the human brain that explains why we love listening to the same music over and over and over again?
There's some. My favorite study on this subject comes from a lab in Spain where what they did, this is Pereira and colleagues, and basically they had people listen to music that was familiar to them or not familiar to them, so music that had been repeated or not, and they used fMRI to look at what was going on in their brain while they were listening. And they found that all the circuitry that underlies our emotional experience of music was more active when they were listening to the music that was familiar, even when that was music they reported not particularly liking. So there's something about having heard music repeated that can engage us, even sometimes against our will. And this experience might be familiar to you. Surely, you know, you've been out somewhere in a movie theater lobby or something, and you find yourself kind of clapping along to something until you realize, you know, it's the earth's most embarrassing, horrible, bad pop song, you know?
Well, or I can tell you from having spent time with teenage children trailing after them in shopping malls, especially in clothing stores where there's music blaring that's really not quite my taste in music. After about six visits, I find myself really, you know, tapping along and thinking, oh, there's that song again. I kind of like that one.
That's the thing. And it's precisely our responses that feel most musical to us when we're compelled to kind of move along, when we have this sense of affiliation or a sense that we're participating along with the music. That's precisely what repetition can set up.
That's interesting that participating along, that suggests that there's something, the way we listen to music isn't actually so much listening to music as it's listening with music.
That's exactly right. So, and again, this I think is really different from other kinds of communication as well. Maybe the easiest way to imagine what I'm describing here is just to think about a moment when you found yourself irresistibly compelled to perform some air guitar, right? I mean, or think about singing in your car. When we're really having the kind of experience with music that's most meaningful to us, and we know a lot about this because there's a Swedish psychologist called Alf Gabrielsson who chronicled thousands and thousands of people's descriptions of their very peak, most intense experience of music. And they reported some sense that they were one with the music fairly often, that some kind of out-of-body kind of experience. And that may all sound kind of loopy until you think back and imagine what it's been like in your life when music has been really maximally powerful to you. There really is a sense that you are kind of moving along or even making the sounds just in your imagination or in your subjective sense in some way.
You make it sound like a mystical experience.
You know, there are some kind of circumstances in which music is used in this mystical way. So you can think about trance, for example, or music in ritual. Or a favorite example of mine is a religious community in France called Taizé. Have you heard about this before?
Mm-mm.
Okay, so this is a community that really interested people because it galvanized youth kind of all over Europe. Like hundreds of thousands of kids were making these pilgrimages to this tiny town in France, and they wanted to understand what's going on here. And it's a Christian denomination, and the way they practice is they all sing together these little tiny brief snippets of music, and they repeat them and repeat them and repeat them and repeat them. And then after an extensive period of repeating these short tunes, they all stop and they're silent. And people report these really profound experiences that it seems like the music's playing them, like it's continuing to bond all of these disparate people even after it stopped. And, you know, when you try to understand what accounts for that kind of an experience, this idea that the music has been encoded in as some kind of procedural sequence so that even when it's stopped, your brain can just kind of keep going over it and over it and over it and almost feels like it's playing you.
It's fascinating thinking about how much of Western music and the Western musical tradition exists because of the church.
Indeed, that's right. And, you know, it's been useful to me because psychologists and musicologists really haven't thought very much about repetition in music. So I needed to look at some other related areas to kind of get a foothold to begin this project. And thankfully, there had been a lot of work about the psychology of ritual. And I was able to find really interesting overlaps there to kind of get me started.
So one question I have about repetition in music and how we like to listen to music over and over again is not all listening is the same, right? There's the listening you do when you go home, you put on a CD or some music that you really like, you go about cooking or whatever you're going to do. It's just in the background. You just kind of like having it there. Mm-hmm. And then there's deep listening, the kind of listening, I mean, as a Peabody Conservatory student, you must be very familiar with, you know, where the music is front and center and you're listening very intently and you're trying to hear into the music, to hear its structure and so many more elements. So it seems like there are very different kinds of listening that we do.
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things we really know very clearly about repetition in music is that when you listen to something repeated, you're not hearing it the same way the second or the third or the 850th time. We've actually tracked how that happens in our lab. We've looked at how the scope of what people are paying attention to changes across the course of those repeated listenings. Now, if you're just making dinner, doing the dishes, and listening to music, you might just kind of use that loop to get into a state of reverie. It might, be useful only in that sense. Whereas if you're at a concert or you're alone, you know, in your comfy armchair with your most excellent headphones, listening to, you know, a piece of music that you really love, what might be happening there is that you're allowing this shift in attention to get you tunneled closer in to some of the expressive nuances that are happening in the performance that aren't available to you just on first pass. So, you know, repetition can be contributing to your experience in both ways, but the way you kind of make use of that could be very different.
One of the most interesting things you point out is that the connection between repetition, music, and speech, and there's this speech-to-song illusion that somebody named Diana Deutsch came up with. Maybe you could explain it.
Sure. Diana Deutsch is a psychologist at the University of California at San Diego. And the illusion actually, the one that's most famous, involves her own voice speaking. And what you hear is simply an utterance, just a regular spoken utterance. And then you hear a snippet from that repeated a number of times. And then what you need to do is just go back and listen to the original utterance again. And for many people, for about 85% of people, you experience a remarkable perceptual shift where at the moment you get to the little clause that's been repeated, it sounds like Diana Deutsch has bust into song in the style of a Disney musical. And it's really quite stunning because, I mean, it's the exact same acoustic signal. So what has changed is the perceptual apparatus we're bringing to understand it, not anything about the sound itself.
Yeah, I didn't hear it as busting into a great big Disney musical, but it did sound as though she she sang that little section of speech a little bit more. And still, I went away from it thinking, I don't know, that's not such a dramatic difference. And then I was walking down the hallway and I found myself humming that little tiny bit of her speech.
It'll get you every time.
It did. It became an earworm, which is another... Oh, wait, let me finish this up first. So what's going on in our brains that makes them convert repeated speech, you know, just a few words repeated, into music?
Well, maybe the easiest way to start thinking about that is to think about a different illusion that we've known about for much longer. This one comes from Severance and Washburn more than 100 years ago, and it's called the semantic satiation effect. And what you do here is you just grab a patient friend and you ask them to repeat a word to you again and again and again for about a minute. And over the course of that minute, some trippy things start to happen. Normally, when you hear a word in a language you speak, it's pretty hard not to just feel the word as a transparent window into its semantic correlate. So if I say light bulb, for example, you know, you picture the little glowing object. But if I say light bulb to you 75 times, it loses its connection to the real world object it typically denotes. And instead, you become hyper attentive to small little subtle things about the word. Like you notice that the L sound returns twice, or that the B is you know, this strange kind of acoustic burst. And it's really quite strange. It's as if, you know, the sound has devolved into nonsense. And it's something you really hear rather than something that you think about and notice. It's a salient change in just the basic way you're experiencing the sound. So there you can notice that across repetitions, you just start focusing on different elements of the word. So in that case, instead of what it signifies, little idiosyncratic things about the way it's being pronounced. So similarly, in the speech-to-song illusion, rather than focusing on what it is that the words are meant to convey, you start focusing more and more on the sonic qualities of the way the words are being pronounced, their pitch level, the rhythm. And all of these elements are, you know, the elements that are used to create music. Mm-hmm. So when you shift your attention in that way, you're shifting over into a musical mode of attending.
So could you turn any sound into music just by repeating it?
That's a great question, because lots of people, when they first hear that example of the speech-to-song illusion, they say, oh, well, her, you know, she has this lovely British accent, and it's all very melodic, and, you know, maybe the deck was stacked in her favor, but just because of the quality of her spoken...
Right. She's an especially musical speaker.
That's right. That's what people say. But... In my classes, I often, when I present this illusion, just ask someone to come up and speak into the microphone, and then we take a little bit of it and we loop it, and we watch for ourselves that no matter what the person just said, we typically can get it to turn into song over the course of a number of repetitions.
I don't know whether I like that or not. There's something slightly creepy about... Does that devalue the composer if you think all composers are doing is just repeating sounds until we hear them as music?
Oh, no, that's a great question, because surely this isn't everything, right? I mean, despite that, we do have really interesting data that show that you can take speech, repeat it, make it seem more musical. In my lab, for example, we took random sequences of sounds, repeated them, caused those to sound more musical to people. But that's not to say that, you know, you can record something in your basement, send it to some top 40 radio station, and become the mega hit superstar Justin Bieber of tomorrow. You know,
in other words,
not.
There's repetition and then there's repetition.
Yeah.
It also depends on what you're choosing to repeat.
That's right. I mean, there's so much other stuff going on. I'm simply saying that there's this practice that's at the bottom and kind of giving air to all of these other musical features, which is putting them on repeat. Just that this is an agent of musicalization, but it's not the only game in town.
Hmm. So another thing you did in your lab, where you asked people to listen to some, I guess you could call it pretty challenging, contemporary art music, music that does not actually have a whole lot of repetition or any kind of easy hook or melody that people can grab onto. And then you changed it. What did you do?
Well, this was kind of a contrary exercise, I have to admit, because I was taking people who aren't specially trained in listening to this kind of music. So this is art music by composers like Berio and Carter, who are deeply loved among a small set of listeners and people who understand this music in the special way that it's asking to be understood, you know, use totally different kinds of processes to make sense of it. But what I was just simply interested in is what happens when you don't have a foothold in this style and it's new to you? How do you make sense of it then? So I could play people examples from this music, either in their original form or a form that I'd manipulated without regards to aesthetic effect. I'd simply gone in and found little bits where it was easy to extract some part and then reinsert it. So I'd basically taken out a little snippet of the music and stuck it back in so that I'd made a kind of perverted version of Berio and Carter that actually used and relied on a lot of repetition.
Mm-hmm. And what did people say when they heard it?
Well, I asked them things like how much they'd enjoyed the excerpt, how interesting they'd found it, and then most fun to me, I'd ask them how likely they thought it was that it had been crafted by a human artist rather than randomly put together by a computer. And on all those counts, they preferred the repeated version. I mean, despite that it was a pretty brute thing that I'd subjected these beautiful pieces to, they thought they were more enjoyable in that condition, they were more interesting, and also that they were more likely to have been crafted by a human artist. So brute repetition was being experienced for them as a kind of handprint of human intent, that it meant the music was trying to speak to them.
Now, that is such a surprising result, I think, because, you know, we're living in the age of digital sampling and, you know, DJs who loop things endlessly. We're living in a very computer-driven musical world, and yet people find that human.
Yeah, that's right. That's a wonderful paradox that you've pointed out there. It's not that people are innocent of the ways that machines make this possible. Not at all. We can hear it in the music all around us, and in advertising especially, probably, but in lots of pop music and elsewhere. But it's just something that you have to hear to believe, because the first time you hear a passage, it can sometimes sound, you know, like, okay, there's this note and then this note, I'm trying to make sense of it. Then you hear it again, and it's as if when you hear that first note, the second note's already contained within it, and it acquires this quality of inevitability where it just feels kind of musically right. And it's something you experience and you hear that we don't normally think about and articulate. So it's really happening at an implicit level that can be quite surprising when it's brought to your attention.
There's another thing you did in your lab. You took, I think, some little small snippets of music and made them sound more musical.
That's right. So we just randomly generated sequences of pitches according to some parameters. And we had a bunch of people come in and rate how musical they found each of these random sequences. And then we had some of them that people rated as pretty low on a musicality scale, and some that seemed pretty musical to them to begin with. And then we brought in a new group of people, and we had them sit back and enjoy a 20-minute exposure phase where they were hearing some of these snippets in their original version and some of them on loop, so 6 times in a row. And 20 minutes is a long time to listen to random sequences of sounds. So typically by the time they were done with that, they're kind of tired. They didn't really remember which they'd heard and which condition. And then they're asked to sit down and listen to each little snippet just on its own and rate how musical it was. What we could show there was that the same little excerpts that had been rated really low in musicality initially had been flipped over and were rated as highly musical after they'd been heard on loop in the exposure phase.
So what does that tell you?
So that's really just tracing the way that across repetitions of little melodies or little tunes, they start to make you want to move along with them, and you just attend to them in a more musical way. So it seems like they're a little tune rather than a bunch of little beeps. You know what? You can see this for yourself by playing around with this app that made its way around the internet a year or two ago. It's called Tone Matrix, and you can find it just by Googling Tone Matrix. And basically, it's a 16 by 16 grid where you can just click around on these little squares at random, and whatever you concoct ends up sounding convincingly musical. And then a question is, you know, how is this happening? And there are two things that are stacking the deck. One is that every square is a little unit of time, and there's 16 of them, so it's kind of predisposed to have a metric framework that you could tap along to. And then also vertically, the boxes stand for notes within the pentatonic collection, and that's just all the black keys on your keyboard. And you might have noticed that if you play around on the black keys, it's a lot more forgiving than if you get some white keys in the mix, just because of the way the collections of notes is distributed. So those are kind of biasing things in your favor when you're playing with the tone matrix. But the real secret sauce, it seems to me, is that it plays through whatever you've created on a loop. So this is taking advantage of the fact that after a few times through, whatever you've come up with starts to begin to sound like something you could, you know, move along to, something you could hum along to.
I don't know. I imagine composers from Bach to Duke Ellington just rolling over in their graves listening to this. I mean, just the message seems like, well, thanks to modern technology, anybody can create a great piece of music and just stack a bunch of things together and repeat them a lot, and hey, we'll go out and dance to it. I mean, it sounds like music is just devolving, you know, into this mindless stuff.
No, and I know that this is, you know, people are nervous about repetition in general for exactly the kind of reasons that you're espousing there. But keep in mind the difference between the sense in which I'm saying that something becomes musical. The sense where you can, you know, your two-year-old can click some boxes on a screen and make a little loop that sounds kind of nice. You could tap to. It's good. Now, that's your two-year-old has not created St. Matthew's Passion or something. There's a whole lot more going on to the music that we love the most. But just like those little, you know, repeated ditties that you might create on your computer in the tone matrix can engage you more after you've been through them a couple of times. That principle holds for the St. Matthew's Passion as well. Despite that, there's so much more going on there, and it's so much richer. And in fact, that very richness may make it even more susceptible to the kinds of magic that repetition can create. Because when you first listen to a piece like Bach's St. Matthew's Passion, we've shown that you're really only capable of zooming in and listening to little bitty snippets at a time. And then once you've heard it three or four times, suddenly your horizon, if you've moved further back, you can take in a larger span of what's going on at once. You can really hear things in there that you couldn't hear the first or the second or the third time. So you're getting more and more from music when there's more and more there to get. So the kind of effect that I'm talking about here might underlie lots of these different musical experiences, but the degree to which the music can take advantage of it changes a lot, you know, depending on whether it's Bach or your two-year-old at the wheel.
Right. So we've been talking about the kind of repetition that's pleasurable in music. Of course, there's another kind that's not so pleasurable. There's a phenomenon, we tend to call it the earworm these days. You know, that piece of music that gets stuck in your head and you just can't get it out, and it can get really irritating. Is that another kind of musical repetition?
That's true, because earworms, I mean, if you think about them, they could have been luxurious. They could just be our own personal life soundtrack, right? But the thing is, they don't work that way. It's not that you get a song stuck in your head and the whole thing goes through accompanying your run or something. Then you wouldn't need an iPod. Unfortunately, what happens with an earworm, typically, is that a fragment of that music gets stuck in your head. And not only is it just this little fragment, but it plays through on repeat. So even in our own minds, when we're imagining music, and sometimes involuntarily, we're stuck in this kind of repetitive sequencing that is so characteristic of the way we experience and use music in the world.
Does everybody have that experience? Does everyone get earworms?
Well, there have been some interesting studies recently trying to look at exactly how common this experience is. And it seems to be that more than 90% of people report experiencing them at least once a week.
So, wow. Once a week?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a lot of people. But this is maybe even more surprising. About a fourth of people report, so 25%, report experiencing them several times a day.
Oh, my God. Several times a day. That's a
Can
lot.
Can you imagine?
That's like musical torture.
And it seems to be associated with musical aptitude or musical behavior. So the more you play music and are involved with music in your life, the more susceptible you tend to be to earworms as well.
Where did that concept even come from?
You know, it's fun because so many different languages have their own funny expressions for the earworm. So in some places, their name translates to tormenting songs or, you know, other horrible things. But they've been around for a long time, we know, because Mark Twain wrote a short story about this sinister earworm that overtook an entire town even before the gramophone had been invented and disseminated. So we know that this was happening even before technology perhaps made it even likelier.
That's fascinating. So, Elizabeth, I'm curious, has spending all this time thinking and writing about repetition in music, has this changed the way you listen to music yourself or the way you experience it?
I think that it has helped me give credence to certain kinds of experiences that are kind of hard to talk about. So when we're listening to music, there's often this sense of absorption or involvement that isn't necessarily emotional. You know, I mean, when people talk about music's expressive capacity, they'll often go straight to emotion. You know, did this music make you feel happy or did this music make you feel sad? Whereas it seems that for me, a lot of the time, the music has just captured me in some way. And it's not necessarily emotionally valenced. I mean, sometimes it is. But that there's something separate going on that's really definitive for me of the musical experience itself. Mm. And thinking about repetition in this way has helped me understand and, you know, have more of a name for and be able to talk about what that experience is like.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about the words we use to describe songs. For instance, we talk about the hook in pop songs, right?
Right.
I mean, it sounds like you're saying that's exactly what happens. It's as though music can kind of hijack your brain, almost appeal to it directly.
Yeah. You know, I don't know that the words we have for talking about music are always as satisfactory as we would like them to be. We often tend to structure our discourse about music metaphorically. So we think about it as a language, or we think about it in terms of something else. And I've been interested in ways to kind of try to get at music, you know, more directly and think about music on its own terms. And, you know, looking at repetition has really helped me do that more successfully.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today. It was fascinating.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.